Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohle right here on LA Talk Radio.
And you are listening on yet what is another summer-like day.
Summer-like, oppressive is the word.
Oppressive,
surface of the sun.
Really?
It's getting worse. You know, it's supposed to go back to what it was. Remember like a couple three weeks ago when it was triple digits for a while?
Yeah.
It's supposed to happen again
this
weekend.
It's going to happen again, I know. Right? It's global warming.
Yes, it is.
But why isn't it happening in other parts of the country?
Well, it's a global thing, so it varies depending on the region of the country you're in.
Oh, I see.
That's it. I don't know why my mother just became the authority
on
weather.
Right?
I don't know why that was his mother's
voice. He speaks in many tongues, but that was her voice.
Yes.
First of all, why don't we thank our sponsors?
Let's do that, Michael.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, of course, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar. Throw some applause right away.
Yes.
The fine people at Performing Arts Live and the fine Mike Napoli, a fellow
Paisan. Right. Yes. One of our favorites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we get to our guest today, who is, and this is so exciting, this show today, Paul.
I'm so excited, Michael. I'm sitting here beside myself.
And that's hard to do.
Yes, I know.
Right? But before we get into that, let me just ask you about something else. Also exciting, but for you.
Yes.
And that was your weekend and your participation in the San Diego Film Festival.
San Diego last week, and then this coming week we have Bel Air, and then after Bel Air we have San Jose International Short Film Festival. For our friends in the studio here, I did a short film called The Beating about bullying and vigilantism.
A beautiful film.
Mental illness, and it's burning up the festivals. We're delighted with the response.
So excited.
And it's not, you know, you don't leave humming a tune. It's not upbeat stuff, but we also... what we're most proud of, probably, is that the script of the film has been added to the curriculum now at Columbia College in their course of study on short filmmaking. So,
what an amazing compliment!
We really couldn't have been more proud of that, especially having written the film myself. I was very proud of that. So we're delighted.
Good for
and
you.
We get to do the Bel Air thing, and Monica gets to do the red carpet thing, which
Monica
she loves.
Monica is his wife.
Which she loves.
Yes.
He said, rolling his eyes to the sky. But anyway, thank you, Michael. And your week, how was that?
Super busy, as usual, getting a couple shows up off the ground at the nightclub, of course, and also getting ready to open Ragtime, the musical for 3D theatricals down in Orange County.
Ah.
Opening in the Fullerton Historic Plummer Auditorium coming up on the 12th. The official opening is on the 11th of October. Then it goes over to Redondo Beach, a performing arts center, in November.
Cool.
Beautiful big production, full orchestra, you know, all the whistles and bells.
Yeah.
Great company down there.
They do a great job.
County,
and I love Ragtime. It's one of my favorite shows.
I've not performed enough
because it's so sprawling. It's a difficult one to do.
I've never seen it.
Really?
No, I haven't. So this will be exciting for me as well. But, Paul, I must admit, as I said, I'm so psyched to be doing the show today because we have with us someone who is not only one of the truly great singers in our business, but known around the world for his critically acclaimed, record-setting, multi-award-winning career on Broadway, which began in 2005 and hit the big screen this past summer as a major movie musical, which, of course, has earned him the title of Major Movie Star.
Yes, and Michael, when you refer to his acclaimed record-setting multi-award-winning career on Broadway, you are, of course, referring to the fact that he is the only American actor in history to win all four Leading Actor Awards for a Broadway debut, and those were the Tony, the Drama Desk, Outer Critics Circle, and Theatre World Awards.
And now, to our listeners out there, if the suspense is killing you not knowing yet who our guest is today, here is a musical hint from his latest CD. Paul Strohle, will you please spin the track?
I certainly will.
Hold me, hold me. Never let me go until you've told me what I want to know, and then just hold me, hold me. Make me tell you I'm in love with you. Hold me.
This is the last you'll find. But they never stood in the dark with you, love. When you take me in your arms and drive me slowly out of my mind, kiss me, kiss me, kiss me, kiss me. And when you do, I know that you will miss me, miss me, miss me, miss me. If we ever say so, kiss me, kiss me, make me tell you I'm in love with you. Kiss me, kiss me, kiss me. And when you do, I know that you will miss me, miss me, miss me, miss me. If we ever say I do, so kiss me, kiss me, tell you I'm in love with you. Never, never, never let me go. Never, never, never let me go. Never, never, never let me go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, from Jersey Boys and the Broadway musical and the motion picture musical of the same name, which I know, having spoke to this gentleman once before, it only scratches the surface of what this incredibly talented gentleman can do. Please welcome Mr. John Lloyd Young.
Hey.
Wow. How are you? Whole audience here.
It
How
is.
Are you?
We spare no expense.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. What an amazing version of an amazing song, because when Mel Carter did that song, it was pretty sensational then.
And this rendition, I mean, you've got chops like to beat the band here, right?
Well, it's a fantastic and exuberant song.
Yeah.
It's the first song that my manager Donna and I chose to put on the album. It was the one that we could instantly agree on. It's just such a great, you know, 60s, it was my favorite one.
And had you known Mel Carter before this, or, I mean, as a person or a friend, or
no? I've
just
since,
knew the music.
I've since known Mel Carter.
Yeah.
I know him now. But yeah,
thank
no,
you.
I just knew the song before.
Thank you for so clarifying that for me, because I didn't hear Mel, I heard Nell. And I'm sitting
Mel
here,
Carter.
Mel Carter has the more varied career than I thought.
Yes,
she's also writing these anthemic 60s rock anthems here.
You know what's really funny is that Nell Carter, you know, Nell Carter did a musical on Broadway called Ain't Misbehavin'.
Yes.
And
sure.
She sang, there was a track on that album, Mean to Me.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah, it's a great recording. And it's funny, you know, when Frankie Valli, the real Frankie Valli, historically, when he was starting out, before they became famous, he would do nightclub acts and he would imitate female singers like Rose Murphy. One of the ways that Bob Gaudio discovered that part of Frankie's voice to write for was he would imitate female singers. And when I was in college, that track from Ain't Misbehavin' was something I would imitate.
Oh,
before
really?
I knew, you know, years before I knew I'd use that falsetto in a more legitimate way.
Boy, what that did for you, using that falsetto.
I did not know that. I did not know that Frankie Valli did that.
I saw Nell Carter actually do the song live on a PBS special. It was one of those salutes the great ladies of Broadway,
right,
or something like that. Yeah.
Was it hosted by Tom Bosley?
No. No, it was not. I can't remember.
Was that just out of curiosity?
No, there was this great, fantastic sort of overview that brought all these original cast members from Broadway shows back, and Tom Bosley hosted it. It was on PBS, and it was in probably like 1984, and it was one of the first sort of introductions to Broadway that I ever had,
I
was obsessed with it.
And just like people, that was a great time too. If it was 84, that was right, because I mean I'm older than you certainly, but the that period of the late 70s, early 80s on Broadway, I was lucky enough to be 16, graduated high school in 82, mm-hmm. and being just outside of
your city. Your drama teacher or something took you.
Yes, she did. I had my mom's from the Bronx, and we lived in Connecticut at the time. But all the shows that she took us to, it was just. I mean, I got to see the original Evita with Patti LuPone and Mandy Patinkin and Bob Gunton and non musicals too. Got to see the original cast of Amadeus with Ian McKellen and Tim Curry, and it was astonishingly good. John, I want to ask you something, because we want to talk about a lot of things today. Obviously, we'll talk about Jersey Boys, if you don't mind talking about it further. You're called on to talk about it a lot, but we do want to talk about that as well as other things that are going on in your career. I do have a question, just as an actor myself and about the process. When you play a role, as long as you did on Broadway, and then you do the film version, obviously you have the technical differences that one is going to have from performing on stage versus performing on film. But I'm curious if that technical process affected anything of the characterization of your perception of playing, you know, a living legend, really, a gentleman that exists and. Did it change a lot for you in the terms of playing Frankie Valli, or was it simply the mechanics of performing for a camera rather than performing in a theater?
Well, it's interesting because in theater, you're a little tiny body on a stage to a lot of the audience because they're far away from you. So you have to scale up your performance to bring your performance up to scale.
Sure.
Whereas in film, it's the opposite. The screen is way bigger than life.
No.
So your performance has to come down to closer to real life.
Sure.
And I found that, and also just structurally from one to the other, Frankie Valli, the end of Jersey Boys on stage is really a master of ceremonies and a narrator. In the film, hardly ever does he talk right to you as a narrator.
Right.
So really what that instantly, just even when I just read the script the first time, I knew that we were going to be watching and observing him, and it wasn't going to be the same kind of performance as on stage where he's taking care of the audience and walking them through the story. It's more that we're looking in on his private moments.
Gotcha.
And so in terms of the scale, it was had to be much closer to the vest and a much more realistic psychological character study.
Right. Okay. I was curious about that for a couple of reasons. One, not only because of obviously the different formats of different mediums, but also I have heard, and I don't know this to be true, and you read things on the internet, and as we all know, the internet is the world's largest bathroom wall. So, the fact that I read, and I don't know if it's so, that Clint Eastwood is not I want to say an actor's director, but is not sort of lets the actor come and do their own work as opposed to micromanaging the individual performances. Did you find that to be the case, or were his notes broader and he allowed you to bring to the table what you brought to the table, or was there a lot of acting notes, or that were the notes of a more technical nature?
You know, it's interesting. It's a deceptively hands-on approach that he has, because he's a man of few words, but the words that he shares with you have a deep impact on your performance. And also, you can sort of kind of feel whether it's going the way he wants it to or not, and you're always aware of him. Meryl Streep was talking in some documentary about Clint's process, about when they were working on Bridges of Madison County, and that she felt like he was very hands-off. And then when she went back and looked at the process, she realized that she was being subtly manipulated at every step of the way.
Okay.
And I think, and that's what, you know, and Clint has well-honed and decades-long, techniques that I think he uses with actors, but he is an actor too. So.
Right. And he's also very musical.
Very musical as an actor. Yeah. But, you know, the best thing is that he invited all of us onto set. We know he's an actor, so we know that he understands any kind of actor insecurity that might arise. He's lived through, and he understands it.
Right.
So it was really like just knowing you could do your work, but you had a safety net. And this safety net was a guy who really knows every single thing that could possibly happen in the mind of an actor and how to address it.
Sure.
When you opened that on Broadway, opening night on Broadway, and saw yourself then, years later, in this wonderful motion picture, what was the sensation you felt sitting there in the audience? I mean, that was a long journey.
Yeah.
Yeah? I mean, not as long as some musicals before they get made, but...
You know, it's funny because you don't really... When you're on stage and you're delivering a character to an audience, you feel like you know what they're getting, but you don't until you're observing yourself. You don't really know. You know, you can sense how the audience is reacting to you, but that's different than looking into a mirror.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You're looking out into this sea of faces, and you see them going with you or crying or laughing or clapping or whatever at everything that you're doing. When you're in the theater, and actually when you do a performance for so many performances, and you get to a point where you can almost be like an air traffic controller over the audience. You get to develop the skill of certain audiences are a little sleepier than others, or some are like more over the top, and you can sort of almost have like control dials on your performance, and you need to adjust to whatever audience is in front of you that day to have a more effective performance.
Yeah.
And when you sit there and you watch yourself on screen, you can't punch up a line to get the laugh. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was the most interesting thing about sitting there. It's that once you've given your performance on a set, then it belongs to the editors and the director, and they piece it together. So it's almost as though it has nothing to do with you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just a member of the audience. And so that's, for me, it was weirdly kind of, I felt less involved than I did on opening night in Broadway because I was sitting with you and you were there.
That's right.
Michael was there. And I think that was the main difference.
Well, it's so much more... I'm sorry, Michael, continue.
Not at all. No, I was just saying, what came into my mind as John was speaking is that 2 days from now, on October 4th, I think was your very first preview on Broadway. Am I right? In 2005?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
9 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's kind of crazy.
But you know what? Actually, something else just occurred to me that I think was very interesting. You know, when The Sopranos was a really big show?
Yes. Mm.
They would talk to those actors about their process, and I thought it was, you know, and I was still in New York kind of doing off Broadway things and studying film acting and class on the side and all that. And so, I hung on every word because I thought the acting was really great on that. And it was either Gandolfini or, you know, it was one of the actors who said that, I'm really excited to see how my character feels about the other characters this season. And what he meant was that you put out all your raw material and then you don't see really the story until the editors put it together later.
Yeah.
And so he was talking about his own work in this kind of, I'm excited to discover what my character is feeling. You know, and that after he had already put it all in the can.
Exactly. Because, I mean, even in the example of the small film that I did, it's only 11 minutes. But when Cirrus, the director, directed it, we had at least three to five different takes, levels of intensity that we would play the scenes at. And then he would hobble together that narrative and the emotional, you know, through line was dictated not by my performance, but what performances he selected and put in the edit. And that to me was fascinating. Exactly. Yeah. What you're talking
it's what
about.
You think you know what you're doing, but then what you think that you might have created, you see that actually once the directors and editors get done with it, it's what they wanted it to be.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
it's very fascinating because it's almost like, how much better could you know a character you've played 1,300 times then again in a movie, right?
Right.
But then you don't know him until you see him. And it was a different guy than I thought I was playing all those years.
Yeah.
A different guy.
And no,
but much closer to real life.
And none of that
exactly.
And none of that immediacy that you have in theater, which is there's no conduit. It's you and the audience. I mean, obviously there's the music and the lights and the things that we have in live theater, but not nearly the quantity of collaboration that
there
is.
You're driving it. When you're on stage, no matter what, no matter how important or famous your director is, once that rehearsal process is over and it's you and the audience, you're the boss, you know, because you're responsible. And, you know, and a movie is a completely different thing because then it's out of your hands and you're more the raw material for right. what happens than the actual thing. And when you're on stage, you're it.
Yeah, I call that a mot point. You know, people say moot point. Mm-hmm. I call that a mot point when right. I was doing the solo show. M-A-U-T, which stands for my ass up there.
You're thing. Absolutely
it's
right.
It's a mot point. Yeah, so whatever say, well, what about this? I said, no, because this is a mot point. What do you mean? Well, mot, my ass up there. And then it was amazing how many arguments were ended with that. That let's play some right. more music. We have so much wonderful stuff here. This track off of John Lloyd Young's CD, My Turn, which is available on iTunes and I'm sure on all sorts of other platforms out there. Amazon and
CD Baby
and all that stuff. Let's play. What do you have as a suggestion here, Michael? We had Hold Me, Throw
I don't think
me,
you can go wrong
me.
With any of them.
But let's. So why don't we do just, our Hurt So Bad?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
This from the CD, My Turn. This is just that Hurt So Bad.
I know you don't know what I'm going through. Standing here looking at you. Well, let me tell you that it hurts so bad. It makes me feel so sad. It makes me feel so sad to see you again. And pins, people say you've been making out okay. She's in love, don't stand in her way. But let me tell you that it hurts so bad. You stay and let me make it up to you. I'll do anything you want me to. You loved me before, please love me again. I can't let you go back to him. Please don't.
No, if only could sing. Yeah. It's kind of sad.
You know what I'm thinking? You know, here? Your voice has become so rich and just tenfold of what it was always a very good voice, don't get me wrong, but there's a maturity, I think, that comes with age and with experience and just doing what you do so well to begin with, and then you start, you know, branching off into doing other projects and concerts and whatnot. And man, oh man, that's a recording that I would certainly want to buy and keep forever.
Yeah. No, right? That's wonderful. You know, Michael, I don't know if I told
you. Thank
you. But I was supposed to actually do the Jersey Boys. I don't know if I told you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I had a personal conflict.
What was that?
I can't sing or dance. Oh, look at the time. Oh, no. John, you mentioned earlier that when you selected the first song for the track, that it was the one that you and Donna had selected that you agreed on immediately. And
Donna Miller, we're talking.
Donna Miller, yes. Yeah. And I'm always curious when one assembles an album, it's almost like I always talk to when Michael has guests here, and also the stage show that you're doing at Sterling's upstairs at the Federal, the process of putting that together, at like songs for the cabaret show or songs for the album. Is it literally just songs that move you? Do you have a theme in mind when you assemble it? Like, I imagine it's different for the album than it would be for a live stage performance. But well, starting with the show that you're doing at Stirling's, what's the process of putting that together?
Well, you know, it's funny because we talked on this program probably, what, 3 years ago?
Yes, at least.
Something like
yeah.
that. You know, and I've lived in L.A. since 2008. And we had talked about doing something Stirling's mm-hmm. before. But I didn't have a playlist that I wanted to get behind yet at that right. point. Repertoire that I wanted to get behind. And we were honing it, Donna and I. And the process of, and you know, this is my first album, so I can't speak for if there is a right process for everybody. I just know the
no,
way
just
we
yours.
Did it.
Yeah, sure.
The way we did it mm-hmm. was, well, I'd been called upon to do certain private events or benefits and sing a song here and there, and clearly because of Jersey Boys, you know, people often requested songs from that era, if not songs from the Four Seasons themselves. But we were really looking for some sort of a way to build a bridge from a double platinum Grammy-winning album where you're singing as someone else to the future where I'd be singing as myself, and felt that the best bridge would be taking other songs from that period that were sung by other people who weren't Frankie Valli and putting my voice on them. So that we could introduce that voice,
an easier
my voice
segue,
for the first
yeah.
time. That's why it's
Smart.
Called My Turn. You know,
right,
this is the
yeah.
first time that my voice come out to play in a public way, and so that was our first. That was our goal
okay.
with putting this playlist together and this CD together, and then it just was actually a really fun process. But it took about 2 years. Here and there between things we were working on of sitting outside at Donna's house at her fire pit, listening to songs yeah. and just did either ones that we already had in mind or just listening to 60s music, you know,
right,
and picking songs and some of them just stood out as like, that's right. And Donna has a really good ear for my voice. And said, I hear you on that. And I was like, oh, I don't want to sing that. I can't sing that. And she'd say, yes, you can. You just have to sing. And so we'd argue back and forth a little bit and then ended up, you know, some of those tracks on the album are my favorite tracks that were arguments, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, Stand By Your Man is a tough sell. I mean, I'm kidding. Stand By Your Man is not on the album.
But that's what, we, you know, and a lot of these songs were working. They were working really well. I was enjoying singing them, and the audiences were liking to hear them. So that was, some of them were pretty obvious to put on the album. And there are some that are going to go on another album that's, you know, it takes time. I have really fantastic and enthusiastic fans, but I'm not in a long-running Broadway show right now, so they can't get at me, you know, see me in a setting. And this is why we did this right now, you know, with Michael and the Stirlings upstairs, because especially after the movie came out, there people want to see me sing some songs on stage. That's mm-hmm. why we did it. Mm-hmm. But really what we're doing right now is with along with my music director Tommy Farragher, who really put this album together with us.
Beautifully so, yeah.
Is we're working on the next one. And it takes a time. This album took 5 years to come together.
Wow.
And that was because it took a few years to get the vision and how do we want to start singing outside of Frankie Valli first.
And yes, but you had a pretty full dance card in that 5 years. It's not like you were sitting home twiddling your thumbs.
Right,
you know?
And that's why things take time. Yeah. You know, there's you come out publicly to do something that has years of preparation behind it, and then... But then when your audience wants to see you again, mm-hmm. one of the tricky things is you still need the incubation time, and that becomes a little frustrating both for them and for me, because I like to be up in front of them, which is why I'm doing Stirling's upstairs.
Right.
And we'll do more things like that along the way. They're coming. It's just, you know, can't announce them yet or don't have them lined up the way we want them yet. But in the meantime, we're still working on songs. Doing Stirling's, for example, when we can, so that people who want to see and hear these songs can do it. And, right. You know, it's a long... Anyway, I have really patient and great fans. And the other thing is they really have my back, because I'm busy working. And, you know, I'm not on Twitter all the time. I don't even have a Twitter.
Right.
I can't keep up with social media because I'm too busy working on things that I want to then bring out publicly, like new songs or finding other great songs to record. And so what's great about my fans is that they kind of take care of me online because I'm not there a lot. Someone says something mean or flames me or whatever, and they're all there defending me immediately, which is I couldn't ask for anything better.
They're going to be there in force on October 13th and 14th. And you know, we set a record with John because those concerts sold out within 4 hours upon its announcement on the 5th of September.
So we got to do some more stuff. Clearly we know that we got it, but this is a good start.
That's a great start.
And I want to talk about it more. We should do our arts calendar, Michael, before, and then we'll get back to chatting with John about the other. I'm interested to talk about the new album as well. But do you want to kick that off?
I will. Thank you, Paul. Sustaining Sound Theater Company, in association with the Chromalume Theater, proudly presents a benefit production of the long-running Tony Award-winning classic You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Set to colorful music and based on the famed Peanuts comic strip, set to music, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown chronicles an average day in the life of Charlie Brown. Follow the journey of all of your favorite Peanuts characters, Charlie, Sally, Linus, Schroeder, Lucy, and of course Snoopy, as they share their observations of Charlie Brown.
Proceeds from this production will be sent to Free Arts for Abused Children, a Los Angeles-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide healing and empowerment to victims of child abuse and neglect through creative and innovative arts programming. More information can be found at www.freearts.org.
And You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is directed by Ovation Award winner Kate Kaplan and produced by Ryan Rawls and Christopher Towers. Rawls, who, of course, you know, is a friend of State of the Arts and the lovely granddaughter of Catherine Grayson.
Yes.
From Sustaining Sound Theater Company, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is directed by, I said Kate Kaplan already. And Chromalume is one of the associate producers, of course, being that it is the theater. It is on stage now, Paul.
Yes.
And it runs through November 2nd at the Chromalume at the Attic Theater, 5429 West Washington Boulevard, Los Angeles. And performances are on Fridays, Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. General admission tickets are $28. Can't beat that, and it's going to a fantastically
wonderful cause.
Students, senior children, tickets are $20. And
senior children.
Senior children. Yes, these are, those are the over eight.
It's like a semi-truck driver. He only drives half the way. What is it?
I don't know.
But you can get your tickets easily by calling the Chromalume Theater box office at 323-205-1617 or purchasing them online by visiting Chromalume Inc. So I'm going to spell that for you. chromolumeinc.com.
Yeah, and we will certainly throw that information out there a couple of more
times before
the end of the hour. But right now we're going to listen to some more music because we're lucky enough to have it, and we're lucky enough to have Mr. Young here for our whole show, which we're just delighted about. So I think it'd be a good time to say, hey there, lonely girl.
Another beautiful rendition of a beautiful song, Lonely Girl. Who was that lonely girl? I mean, do you know about that, John? I know you have a personal connection with this song.
It actually was a lonely boy.
Really?
Originally, the song was written for a woman, and it wasn't until Eddie Holman did his version that it became a hit.
Mm-hmm.
But
who wrote this song?
Earl Schumann. Now, I have an interesting story about that.
Yeah.
A lot of these songs have been honed at gigs that I've done over the last couple years at the Carlisle Hotel in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first debuted there, I was singing this song and others from this album, and I looked back at the bar area, and there was a silhouette of an older man with a cane. And at the end of the show, he came up and introduced himself to Donna, was there, and myself, and turned out that this was Earl Schumann, who's the writer of this song. It was his biggest hit. He had read in the New York Times that I was singing this song at the Carlisle, and so he came to see the show. And it's really interesting when one of the questions I get asked the most by fans of Jersey Boys is, have you met the real Frankie Valli? Which, of course, the answer is, of course. You know, I met him even before we opened on Broadway all those years ago. Do you know the real Bob Gaudio? Absolutely, you know. And that's been a real privilege to meet these guys who we were portraying and that, you know, I'm singing as Frankie, et cetera. But now, having recorded these songs, getting to meet Mel Carter, because I recorded his big hit, and meeting Earl Schumann because I was singing his big hit at the Carlisle. I'm meeting all of these guys from this era now, mostly by accidentally being an ambassador of their music in 2014.
Excitingly.
And we're lucky to have so many of them that we still do. The creators of this music.
Well, they don't write music like this anymore.
They don't. And more importantly, they don't produce it like this anymore either. One of the things, hearing just a few tracks that I've heard, and there's a wonderful, and it's, I know it's a trite term and it's an archaic term, but there's a wonderful wall of sound feel to it. Yeah. There's that wonderful thing that Phil Spector created.
You know, Donna and Tommy Farragher and I and all the musicians, and everything, we know that this is a retro project. We're doing it on purpose this way, because there's a lot of things today are very, very highly produced, and a lot of the sounds are synthetic. And this is a nod to the way things used to be done. And in fact, a lot of these songs we recorded here in Santa Monica at the recording studio. It's called. It's where the Beach Boys recorded Pet Sounds.
Wow.
Nice.
So some of the things that were the places that we're recording are places where a lot of these songs were originally recorded, or from the era when these songs were recorded. It really is like going back into time. And
you know,
doing it the old way.
Pet Sounds inspired Sgt. Pepper. A lot of people
don't
know that. A lot of people don't know that.
It was the
Beatles listening to Pet Sounds that made Sgt. Pepper what it was. I want to stress in making that comment earlier that I did about the wall of sound, and you mentioned overproduced. That's what's so nice about this, is that it's there, but yet your vocal is obviously strong enough and powerful enough that we're not lost in a mishmash of production. It's not there as filler. Your voice is sitting right on top of it. It augments it rather than, because that's something, especially now with all of the celebrity singers that we have, that without a whole lot of electronics would not really be singers at all.
And who knows? I mean, maybe sometime in the future I'll experiment with something that's a little more contemporary.
Sure.
But right now our project was to do something very authentic and as kind of an homage and a throwback to songs that I really, really love and that we love. And that the audiences are loving, and it's as an opportunity to kind of enjoy that, something comfortable and something very well known and familiar.
John, did you have an affection for this music before Jersey Boys? Did you love sort of this pre-Beatles 60 or early 60s music? Where were your musical tastes before you got this role of a lifetime?
My musical tastes were actually the same as a lot of these guys that were singing these songs. That my musical tastes were Sinatra or Orbison and those sort of pure sounds. And, a lot of the people that Frankie Valli and some of his contemporaries would say was his main influences were also, that was the music I was listening to.
Right.
My grandparents' music was my music too. Yeah. Sinatra and his phrasing and that on those recordings it felt like he was singing directly to you,
yeah.
And that, and then so it was a very natural fit. These songs from the '60s that were sung by all these people influenced by those older songs, to then approach the lyric the same way that that generation would have approached a lyric. And there's a little overlap with the whole Broadway tradition of mm-hmm. of sending over the lyric is very important and much more important than in pop songs today or in the last 30 yeah. years, you know, where the lyric sometimes you can't even really hear what the words are.
Yeah.
So that
or understand it.
So for me, it was a very natural fit to kind of then take pop music where the lyric was still primary and where it required feeling and interpretation.
Right.
Well, and you know, that's much my approach too with the nightclub, you know, preserving this kind of opportunity for this kind of music to be heard, whether it's Broadway music or whether it's great American pop standards like this. It's important to me. It was always important to me, and Rosemary Clooney, being my mentor in my lifetime, taught me all these things, and especially having the opportunity to road manage her for the years that I did. It was something that I said to myself then, I am going to do this at some point in my life. I don't know when, but I will.
And there's, and you know, it's not a, I don't think it's an accident that two of the biggest albums out right now are Barbra Streisand and Tony Bennett
mm-hmm.
singing with younger artists.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a good song is a good song, and it doesn't go away. And some of these songs on this album are not songs that are covered very often.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, when they think of standards, they're thinking of war era music, the World War II.
Yeah, right.
But it's about time for these songs that are 50 years old to also enter the consciousness as standards as well.
I mean, yeah, but there's
should be singing them.
But there's nothing sort of there. I mean, there's nothing like. I don't want to say it is nostalgic, but it doesn't seem like manufactured retro. When the songs are these good and the vocal is this good, they're timeless. You don't hear, it's not like, oh, you know, he's dusting off these old tracks. I mean, Hey There, Lonely Girl Hurts So Bad. It's just those vocals and those song deliveries are just, they're timeless, you know? I mean,
they're really relatable songs. I mean, which is another reason I think why Jersey Boys has been such a big hit. Not just because the show and the story is great, but because the songs are still relatable all these years later. I mean, you're not going to get a 14-year-old kid to want to see the Jersey Boys movie three times with his parents unless it's reaching him in some way. And that's happening all the time. And it was happening when we were opening on Broadway. There were kids who wanted to see it. And it doesn't happen if the music is like fuddy-duddy and old and not relatable.
Mm-hmm. I think that you mentioned Orbison, and I think that's one of his great connections, in addition to having, a much like you, this wonderfully pure stepladder falsetto. Roy Orbison, Elvis's favorite singer, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't so much, even though he was so technically gifted, it was how he performed the song. You know, as Springsteen says, Orbison is the bard of the lonely. And the way people, especially young men, would connect with that vocal is beyond the vocal prowess of the singer. It's the connection. It's the emotional connection.
I got to tell you, I don't want to sing a song unless I can connect to it emotionally or unless I feel like I have something I want to communicate through it. So some of the fights that I've had with Donna, arguments over which songs go in the playlist, have had to do with the fact that I couldn't see myself into the song right away. But then, you know, I've been convinced, like the last song that you guys have today, that was an argument that Donna won, and thank God, because now that song, I see the audience, it goes over so well, and I'm, thank you for making me do this.
John's talking about Unchained Melody, which we're going
to... Before we... Well, we either play now or because we have to, you know, baptize him
We have time. We have like 5 minutes, so if we give 3 minutes to him sharing a tale. I didn't mention this to you, John. I don't know if you remember it before, from last time you were here, but we always like people to share an experience of something that went wrong on stage, some mishap, something that you struggled through, I imagine, with a number, from any performance.
Doesn't
not
mean
necessarily,
live on stage. It could be from the film or films or television appearances.
Well, I have a great story, a really humiliating one, which is always really fun for an audience to listen to.
Okay.
That's what we like.
Because it means you're real.
What do you got?
The first show that I ever did out of college, and I looked much younger than I actually was, and I played, I was getting my equity card at the Westchester Dinner Theater in Westchester, up above Manhattan.
Oh, yeah.
And I was playing
White Plains.
I was playing Tom of Warwick in Camelot. And I said, the big scene at the end where I, you know, talk to the king or whatever, and then I run off, you know, because he, I don't remember. He gives me a bow and arrow or something. It's like a big moment for a little kid. I was playing like a 14-year-old, just graduated college. Well, this was a dinner theater, and it's some of the performances for, were for kids. And at this particular performance, the kids had were having fun throwing green beans onto the stage, and so I had my big, you know, my big exit, and it was this high emotional moment, and I slipped on a green bean straight in my behind.
Not so jolly, green.
However,
giant.
You know, I don't. I really think by that time Camelot had lost them. They were throwing food onto the stage, so it really,
I was gonna
they
say,
really weren't that engaged with the emotional content of the.
There were
the
green
show
beans
point,
on the
anyway.
Stage. You had larger problems at play here.
Oh, we called that. The curtain up, chow down.
Oh, that's hysterical.
What a delight to have you back, John, with us, and Donna Miller on the radio with us. So you haven't said much, but
yeah,
you look beautiful.
Lovely to have her with a lovely.
Well,
woman.
she's lifted the you know the beauty bar in the.
She has.
By many degrees here in the studio. So
yes,
but we're going to hear this last track of John's.
We are going to, and we want to put the information out there not only for this thing that was in our arts calendar, but
yes.
Michael, I'll read that, and then if you would remind people. Well, actually, there's. I guess there's not really too much of a need to sell tickets to the Sterling's Upstairs at the Federal thing since it sold out so quickly.
The only one thing that his fans can hope for is that he will return at some point and they can see him in the future. So.
And, John, the name of the, as a reminder, the name of the album, My Turn? That's the name of the CT?
Yeah.
Okay, and your website is just yourname.com, johnlloydyoung.com?
Yes, it is.
And there's also John Lloyd Young Friends on Facebook, which is where all the latest news will be.
Right.
Okay. And in regard to what Michael mentioned earlier about this production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, that raises money for such a good cause, which, by the way, I was Snoopy in this, one of the first musicals I ever did. Yes.
Now, that I could see.
Yes. I was. Well, you know, I had...
No singing or dancing involved.
I dabble in that stuff.
Oh, you do.
The website, chromalumink.com, and for tickets, 323-205-1617.
That's it.
We're going to have Mr. Young play us off the air here with a classic song made famous by the Righteous Brothers. And... once again, created by with that whole wall of sound that Phil Spector was known for before he became the Phil Spector that unfortunately he became. But this is John's take on it, which I'm sure is just staggering. And the song is called Unchained Melody. This will play us off the air, so
we
will say our goodbyes.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Donna.
Thank
you, Paul.
Pleasure having both of you here, and we look forward to chatting with you all next week.
Sterling and Paul Strohle, right here on LA Talk Radio.